Blog Talk Radio.
Goldstein, the futurist. We're live at HIM17. It's Wednesday. I have Rick Krohn, one of the leading thought leaders around emerging technology. What connected health, mobile health,
e-health,
virtual health, and you got several talks today. But Rick, tell us kind of a bit about you, and then let's talk about your talks today.
Well, let's start at the beginning. About 20 years ago, I was a new employee working directly for Douglas Goldstein, and I can never thank him enough for helping me get established in this industry. I've since moved on to health IT consulting, and as a means of promoting the practice and establishing myself as sort of a luminary in the field, I've written several books. Fortunately, those books have been published by Inns in 2012 on mobile healthcare, moving on from the concept of mobile health to connected health. A book that Doug is holding in his lap is just been published at this conference, and it is on the topic of connected health. It's a contributed book, so we have a variety of healthcare luminaries from across the spectrum of healthcare talking about how connected health is being implemented, you know, in their practices, in their enterprises, or on a population health basis.
So how is this different than the mobile health book? What evolved from the mobile health book that I contributed to a couple years back?
Well, our contention is that there's been three phases of connected health. The first was in the 90s when it was all about just connectivity. The second phase was about mobility, which was in the mid-00s. And now we're talking about the personalization of health. And our books have sort of traversed the same path, talking about how healthcare has moved from being an enterprise and a siloed sort of phenomenon to being more personal, more retail, more consumer-oriented. And this book sort of illustrates that through several case studies about wearables, about things like virtual health or virtual healthcare, and about the ways that the consumer becomes more integrated and more engaged in healthcare.
So what's the biggest takeaway or the biggest insight you think from this book relative to the enterprise challenge of going from a business-to-business wholesale industry to a direct-to-consumer industry?
I think if you want to kind of sort of an umbrella concept, I think it's about the whole calculus of healthcare is changing. So the patient is becoming more embedded into the whole circle of care delivery. The patient is becoming more accountable for their own healthcare, and the patient is less the person of the sort of the end of the loop in healthcare and more sort of the central figure in healthcare.
So what are the key recommendations that you would share with healthcare executives trying to make the transition from just dealing directly with payers and with consumer responsibility and out-of-pocket increasing and moving to this whole next generation of person empowerment and shift of risk to providers and patients?
Well, traditionally, healthcare has been kind of hidebound, and I think that there has to be sort of a real sort of evolution in thinking about how healthcare is going to occur in the future. There's a lot of talk about hospitals becoming just basically acute care and emergency rooms in the future, and how healthcare is going to occur in such different ways that there won't be a need for bricks and mortar the way that they have that today. I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen overnight, or suggesting that there's not a need for enterprise level physical structures to conduct care. What I am suggesting, though, is that healthcare is simply going to occur differently in the future. It's going to occur differently because there are means to personalize, to sort of create healthcare mechanisms, tools like a Fitbit that I'm wearing right now, or channels of communication that allow the patient to actually be involved in healthcare when they're not sitting face-to-face with a physician, and healthcare mechanisms that allow patients to become more proactive, more accountable, and hopefully more preventive in the terms of healthcare maintenance.
So I do a lot of work in personalized health, the intersection of wearables, electronic health, omic data, with the Inova Center for Personalized Health. So we're on the forefront of that. The challenge that I think health systems have is that all our systems are structured for transactions.
Right.
We've trained everybody, the reimbursement, so follow the money. And still, despite all the conversations about value, less than 5 to 10% of the actual risk is shifted to providers in value-based agreements. So we're stuck with infrastructure trained for transactions, organized for transactions, and we're trying to move to a value world and longitudinal outcomes of events, because what happens to somebody after a knee replacement depends on what they do. Do they gain weight? Do they have physical therapy? It's not just the surgery and the doctors.
Right.
So I think the biggest person left out of the whole equation of shared savings is the person.
Right.
They're not participating.
And they're at the if there's closed loop communication, they're at the end of the loop. There's two things that might serve as sort of the engine of change. One is, Doug, as you mentioned, is follow the money. So if payers, if the people who are actually footing the bill, you know, determine that there's a value in sort of shifting, you know, responsibility and accountability from the provider onto the patient, and the patient incented to actually become more accountable, I think you'll see that there's more of an enterprise focus to healthcare and more of a personalized focus. The second is healthcare is becoming more retail. And that's no more obvious than in, you know, sort of the wearables market, where, you know, the biggest source of revenue for wearables right now is on the consumer side. Health and fitness, people who are, you know, the health conscious. And that has, you know, sort of an adjunct value to healthcare delivery, in that it's making the person, you know, that the patient is more of a healthcare consumer than a patient at this point. So those are, I think, it's the two big drivers. But I would acknowledge that, you know, healthcare is, you know, the dinosaur of, you know, technology delivery. I wouldn't consider or describe healthcare as being at the forefront of innovation. So there is a cultural issue as well.
Well, I think we have a couple tracks of innovation. I think that health and medical care has adopted a lot of innovations, and I think we have to separate clinical innovations in terms of minimally invasive surgery and even minimally invasive surgery and early EROS, early ambulation of patients, from technology. And the problem is the regulations and reimbursement systems. And we had, you know, one of the leading telemedicine companies here, the regulations of doctors in every 50 states. So we have a number of barriers and hurdles in implementing certain information technologies.
Well,
what's your recommendation to the we're about to change policy. So what's your recommendation to the Republicans and Democrats and leaders on the Hill who are going to flip the apple cart again in healthcare policy?
And that's a real concern there, because, you know, what replaces what we have right now? So is it going to sort of, you know, flip back to, you know, high level, you know, top down enterprise, you know, led, you know, healthcare delivery? Or is there just going to be, you know, block grants given to the states, you know, from which they decide, you know, where the most value can be distilled? I don't know. I mean, that remains to reveal itself. But also, you know, to your point, Doug, I think that there needs to be, you know, some sort of, you know, path of connectivity between traditional healthcare delivery, the way the systems that we have in place, the infrastructure that we have, and what's rapidly emerging, which is a new sort of, you know, cultural shift in the way that, you know, healthcare, you know, engagement occurs. It's not necessarily in a physician office. It's not necessarily in the emergency room. You know, it may be happening more at a distance. It may be happening in the home. You know, maybe in facilities that, you know, now don't require as much intensity as a hospital, let's say.
So do you see health systems and physician leaders really moving from transaction to relationships?
Not kicking and screaming. physicians by and large are not entrepreneurial. They are not pioneers. So I wouldn't suggest that, you know, they're leading the charge. They're not. But if you can provide incentives to physicians to be more proactive in, you know, and again, we're talking about value-based care. But if you can, and getting away from, and, you know, if they rely on transactions, if they rely on fee-for-service, there is no incentive. But if there is a value in, you know, if, you know, performance-based measurement, if, you know, physicians can be incented to keep people out of their offices, yes, there's a real opportunity here to, and this is on a population basis. You know, you can do it with chronic care. You can do it with people who are in, you know, remote areas or specific populations. But I think that there are ways that, you know, physicians, even hospitals, can be incented. And, you know, it's, you know, forget ACA or ACOs for the moment. But if there are ways, you know, at a high level through CMS or through Humana or through people who are actually footing the bill to, you know, to incent providers to, you know, kind of deliver care in new ways such that it's not retrospective, it's not reactive, it's not treatment, it's, you know, diagnostic and, you know, forward leaning and, you know, preventive.
no, we need data to support the move to value and outcomes. But I believe that, and I interact with a lot of physicians that are doing the right thing to the detriment of their financial
right.
incentives. I have a lung cancer surgeon who's been following patients for 9 years relative to recurrences and whatever. He's not reimbursed for that, but it's the right thing to do
right.
for patients. So I think that we have many, many physician leaders who recognize that they're caught in an old reimbursement follow the money system, and we really need policy change, but we also need data to support those value and outcomes
and
that we know how to really price a longitudinal episode of care.
You know, and that's the Achilles heel of healthcare, is that we are sort of stuck in a reimbursement system that doesn't value innovation or entrepreneurship or answering a higher calling in terms of providing services. The second thing is that I don't want to misrepresent physicians in any way. There are physicians who are drawn by a higher calling that do feel that they need to provide services that may or may not be reimbursed. So I do want to make that point. The second thing is when we talk about data, Doug, that is a double-edged sword too, because there's a real danger that by creating channels of data communication, physicians particularly can become overwhelmed. And they already complain about that. What information do they really need? How much of it is relevant? How much of it is simply adding layers of complexity to their practice? And I don't think we've kind of noodled through that and kind of figured out what how to smooth out the rough edges of data. I agree that we need to have data-driven decision making, but at the same time, I think that we have to be wary of creating too much data.
Well, I think the data overload to the care team and the doctor can be handled with artificial intelligence or machine learning in the cloud, relative to priorities and what in the context of a certain patient care. But let's what's your favorite chapter in here, and how do people get the book? Because there's a lot of insights that we talked about that will guide people forward in terms of navigating how to apply technology to create a connected ecosystem, correct?
My favorite chapter was written by Rick Crone. and it's actually something.
Mine too.
It's actually the chapter I wrote on virtual reality, because it is very forward leaning and it's very it's perspective, and it sort of kind of heralds in this new era of technology-driven care. As far as the book itself, it's available on Amazon, but it can be purchased at the HIMSS bookstore or through CRC Press.
So that's Connected Health. And how do people get in touch with you?
My email address is rkrohn, R-K-R-O-H-N, at healthsen.com. My practice is healthsen.com. So I encourage you to contact me.
And your Twitter handle is?
It's at Rick Crone.
And that's how you can search for the book. So thanks for joining us today. And
Enjoy it, Doug.
Leading the way and the luminary work you're doing to help people navigate smarter.
Thank you, Doug.
Awesome.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Long time, Doug. Long way. So tell me, what are you doing now?
I'm responsible for business development innovation at Inova. So we acquired the former ExxonMobil campus. No, I just started. And actually, I'm not doing most of the talking. You're doing most of the talking. Back in the saddle again, HIM 17. I have Dr. Sydney Smith, who Antigen.
Antigen.
You're an innovator, a physician, leader, and what does Antigen do?
Well, the name Antigen actually means hair growth. It's a growth cycle of hair.
I need some more hair, huh?
It's the growth cycle. But the reason we formed our company was there's some solutions that I need as a physician that just don't exist in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And some glaring deficiencies for patient safety that we really had to build for my clinic.
And what was the gap in patient safety, and what did you build?
Well, we do things very differently than the rest of the world does. We actually track events Everybody in this office or this whole building tracks patients. The entire communications industry of the world does it differently than we do in medicine.
So okay, help me understand the difference between event and...
All right, but you know the answer to this. Think of FedEx.
Yes.
Think of the hotel you stayed in last night.
Yes.
The plane.
Yes.
They all gave you one thing in common, and that was a confirmation number.
Okay.
That is the only way they're able to keep track of the money, the communication, the event, the outcome, your quality of stay. It's all based on tracking numbers. So medicine is communication. How do you track that a patient was told their results? Very poorly. Let me tell you how poorly it is. You ready? The third leading cause of death is this industry and this environment. The third leading cause of death. According to a study from Johns Hopkins last year, medicine errors ranks number three right after heart attacks and strokes. How about that?
Okay, so you've developed a system that tracks events?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And people get confirmation numbers where we go?
Absolutely. Let me tell you
how. From womb to tomb?
From womb to tomb. From point of service through completion of service, we actually track the entire event. And it doesn't matter what EHR you have, doesn't matter what lab you have, doesn't matter what network you're on, none of that matters.
So it cuts across all specialties?
Everyone. Let me tell you how it works.
Okay. How does it work?
All right. So you're going to go on a plane flight. Delta gives you your confirmation number.
Yes.
You pay your money.
Yes.
You actually communicate with them. You show up. They have a little number for you. You go on the plane, and you get off the plane. Everything is in one central location. You can go back and look at that event, know when you made the schedule, when the plane took off, how much you paid, everything.
Just like when I got my Alexa from Amazon, I had a tracking number through the whole process.
Absolutely.
Right?
So it's the same exact concept. So what we do is, what I noticed, there's two things that are a problem in medicine. When I took your biopsy, I assigned a unique identifier code, just like FedEx. I share that with you, the patient, the physician, the lab, the medical malpractice company, and soon CMS. So everybody knows in real time what's going on. Then you track it with your smartphone, just like you're tracking your shipment from Alexa.
And this is what antigens do.
This is what we do. We've been doing it for 2 years. But let me tell you this. We drive that data right into the LIS of the lab. So there's no errors in communication. No data. All the data is secured. You actually have a window as a patient as to when that data went over, when the results come back. You also
at the center of the solar system, and that is a major shift in how the practitioners in the field, astronomers, view the universe. That's a paradigm change. It always takes a generation, largely because it's funny, Max Planck, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said in 1918, a new scientific truth does not win acceptance by persuading its opponents. It wins acceptance because its opponents eventually die. A new generation comes up.
Sure.
Right? Now, I would rather, even if in the old generation, I'd rather survive the new you.
Sure.
We need to be patient and be the important thing is be clear about what's reality versus what seems to be reality.
So let's connect this into healthcare then, because I'd love to get your perspective. What do you think as far as healthcare is concerned then? Are we in the midst of a paradigm shift? And if so, where are we? Are we at the crescendo of it? Are we just starting out? What do you think?
Well, so there is something, one of the Thomas Kuhn in his book about paradigms points out how one of the major obstacles to a paradigm shift, and it's a culture, not just a scientific discovery, because the scientific discovery is commonly not accepted, because it means that all the people in charge of the wrong view are wrong, and they tend to be unhappy about that. A good example of this, the most recent one that I know of, is when the field of economics was turned upside down over the last 30, 40 years by the discovery of behavioral economics. Once the evidence that the old view doesn't work gets going, fights break out at conferences. People in the establishment or in journals writing papers about how stupid the new view is. People fight for their lives academically. So in healthcare, there's an additional problem, and the following is not a complaint, even though people think it's a complaint. The financial reality of the structure of the industry makes it very hard for people to start operating differently.
Correct.
Because the reimbursement will not follow the new model.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a much greater problem in the U.S. than anywhere else in the world.
Correct.
And so we are at the stage where there are several companies here. I won't name names because that's not what I'm here for, but there are several companies here now, far more than in the past, that are really about giving patients full access to the information
mm-hmm.
about themselves, their families, their kids, their elders, really truly. Now, that's where it becomes useful to have a secure public storage thing, publicly accessible, controllable by me. You know, I'm famous for the song that Ross Martin made famous, right? Give me my damn data, right? It's all about me, so it's fine. Well, in contrast to that, you take a look at Harlan Krumholtz of Yale, who also has a PHR company, Hugo PHR. He said at the Connected Health Conference in the fall, he had, in the process of talking to providers about offering this pull all the patients' records together for them thing, a senior executive at a California system, not Kaiser, in case anybody's wondering, said, you don't understand. We need affinity and loyalty. Why would we make it easier for one of our customers to leave us? Well, that's the business reality.
It is.
Sure, it'll take a generation for the old view to basically age out of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Kids today, including medical students, I gave a lecture at Dartmouth's Medical School earlier this month, they get it. They grew up in the world of course, it's my data,
and
so on. But meanwhile, it makes sense also to sort of activate the public, the consumer, the patient, what I call the person who actually has the problem.
Sure.
Right, to help them be in better control.
Right, and being vocal about what they want and what needs they
want. I'm glad you mentioned that because that's so important, because so often after I give a speech, some people will say, well, my patients aren't like you. They're not asking for this. So we really need to speak up. And the funny thing about that is I'm fond of quoting that in the 1912 election in the U.S., women's suffrage was on the ballot. And the anti-suffrage people, some of whom might have been jerks, I don't know, or some of them might have been really just honest, concerned thinkers. The brochure said no on suffrage because 90% of women aren't asking for it. Exactly the same thing.
Oh, it is exactly the same thing. And I'm reminded of that Henry Ford quote. You know, he had said something along the lines of, if he had asked his customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
Yeah.
And this is very much in that same vein where it's like sometimes you're not exactly sure on a broad scale, like the mass, the
right.
population isn't exactly sure what it is that they're asking for, but then it starts to become clearer over time.
Well, and nobody was asking for an iPhone.
Right.
When it came out. That's the Steve Jobs thing. Nobody was asking for an iPad. Who would have thought that within 10 years...
We can't live without them.
Well, you'd have things like this. I mean, this is an FDA-approved EKG.
Now, for everybody who can't see this, we've got e-patient Dave holding up his phone, and he's got... What are these sensors on the back of it?
These are electrodes.
They're electrodes, and it is an EKG that you can do through your phone.
It's a single-lead EKG.
That's incredible.
Not as fancy as the six wires on your chest.
Sure.
But the guy who's famous for... expressing the need for this is Hugo Campos.
Sure.
And he can tell, without being in the doctor's office, he has a bad heart, he can tell whether an arrhythmia that he's having, just by putting two fingers on the back of his iPhone, whether it's VTAC or AFib or whatever, It hasn't put doctors out of business. It
right.
hasn't put hospitals out of business. It just gives more information to the person who has the problem.
And that's really what it's all about, right? It's getting more information to the patient.
So at the same time, I've heard executives say that they have a responsibility to the organization that hired them to protect the finances. So they, while they're doing their job, we need to do ours,
right?
Which is stick up for our families.
Definitely. Well, e-patient Dave, I could talk to you all afternoon. I truly could. But we appreciate you stopping by here at the Conversa Health booth and speaking with us with Health Innovation Media. We are going to be talking now to, I think, Matthew Holt has finally made his way over from wherever he was. So I believe he's
goodness.
Going to be sitting with us. Is that right? as soon as we can get him out of the conversation,
okay.
He's wrapped up in. But ePatient Dave, thank you so much. And for anybody who wants to read your blog about blockchain, where can they look for that information?
So just Google ePatient Dave, spell it any way you want, and I'm the only one that comes up. When you get there, search for blockchain.
Definitely. ePatient
okay.
Dave, it's a delight to speak with you. Enjoy the rest of
Thanks
him.
So
thank
much.
You so much. Thank you. Okay, so we have a change in programming here that I've been just surprised of. So we are going to have Doug joining us back, and he's going to be sitting down for a moment with another guest. So, Doug, come on back over.
Thank you.
No problem. Pleasure to have us.
Good to be
Thanks
back
so much.
E-Futurist, HIM-17. Dr. Delaney, one of the leaders in precision medicine, genomics, and with SAP, and
Absolutely.
You, which has invented some incredible platforms. And we had one of your associates from France here yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So give us quickly, what do you think about HIMSS? Is HIMSS, are these technology companies on track?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of, discussion and, you know, some really good direction and momentum we're getting. I mean, the focus on making data more interoperable, your liquidity, and really being able to leverage it. I mean, to really make progress on the journey to value-based care, we have to be able to really integrate the data from the clinical sphere, the financial, operational, and claims at a service line level, right? And that's kind of the starting point where organizations can truly begin to understand care delivery and begin to actively manage it. And so I think we're making good progress. I think people have their arms around what the problem is. Things like fire, standards, they're beginning to emerge. And I think vendors, too, are beginning to support interoperability to a greater degree.
Right. So when we talk about any of these specific areas, social, environmental data, electronic health data, user-generated data, and then the fourth quadrant is omic data.
Yeah, yeah.
That, the devil's in definitely the details there because the complexity of that data is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And that's been a focus of what you're doing at SAP, correct?
Yeah, and we're definitely playing in the omics space. I think it's really interesting. It's one area where you never lose a bet in terms of the complexity. it always seems to be more complex. Even the epigenetics, governing everything else around
right.
it, right? So I think it's interesting also in terms of how you begin to pull the data from the omics sphere and begin to mash it up with clinical data, because there's really no real standards today in terms of how to accomplish that. And it's really, a lot of uncertainty around what parts to bring in. I think everyone feels it's going to be big, but not right now in the next few months or year, right? And so everyone, I think, has their eye on it, but it has a lot of uncertainty around how it's going to actually shake out.
Well, if you're a cancer patient, I mean, from an immediate need standpoint, I think the huge complexity of cancers, how cancers change, trying to create a longitudinal perspective, getting the data to best treat patients. I think that there's from a cancer patient perspective, the need is now.
No, for sure. I mean, I think we're at the point now where, every cancer patient should be sequenced and should identify if there's a mutation or some kind of, genetic marker that would indicate one treatment being superior to another. And it's just because when it works, it can work fabulously well. And so I think we're to that point. And sadly, many patients aren't being sequenced. And sometimes the sequence information, the mutation information isn't even being leveraged necessarily to drive the right therapy. So I think, as is always the case that, in healthcare, unfortunately, I mean, it takes often a decade plus to get, over 50% of the practitioners practicing what's known to be, the evidence-based medicine. So this is an ongoing challenge. sure.
So can you give us some examples of how SAP is providing the ability for providers to address the challenges, some specific examples of, I know you're doing amazing things in soccer, but what are we doing? What are you doing in health? And you might want to mention the soccer stuff too.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So, you know, SAP being a German company takes great pride, you know, in helping power a lot of decision making around the German soccer team, which of course won the World Cup.
Just the World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and they use, you're saying they used your technology to help them win the World Cup. That's what
We would like to think we played a small part in it. But yeah, I mean, we gave them, you know, the ability to analyze players' motions and cadence and really, you know, everything from, you know, when people are taking a penalty shot, where they're likely to go with it based on historic data. So it can be pulled up on the field, you know, to tracking motion and the players, right? Because if you look at players, obviously, you know, soccer, aggressive sport in terms of the physicality of it, right? And people begin to tire, and so we can begin to predict when they're starting to go toward the downside in terms of performance. You know, can swap people in and really get more technical in terms of how you're doing it. So there's a huge amount of strategy in that. So yeah, we're actually doing that. But in the area,
that's like nano coaching, right? I mean, that's a huge detail. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you have that. You have this incredible expertise, but how are you making it work in healthcare?
Yeah, so I think healthcare, the fundamental challenge is, you know, and I felt this as a clinician that practiced for 14 years as a critical care physician. You know, oftentimes I had to make very, you know, challenging decisions with a very limited data set. You know, we know there's data out there in other silos within the institution or maybe out in the cloud, the web somewhere. That might make us help us make a better decision around the patient, but it just you couldn't bring it to bear to the point of decision for that patient, you know. And so, beginning to do that with HANA to really accelerate that process. And in the area of oncology, like we talked about before, you know, it's an area where you look at it, only about 5% of patients are enrolled in clinical trials, and that might be okay if the other 95% were well represented. But the 95%, you know, oftentimes they're older, sicker, more ethnically diverse.
Right.
They have other medical problems, you know, any of which would have prevented them from being in the clinical trial. They would have been excluded from trial. Yet that's kind of all you have to guide the therapy, that and the therapeutic choice, that and you know, the individual clinician's memory of, you know, patients who seem kind of similar to you. Seem to do well in this med, and another patient who seems to really didn't do well in this,
right.
So I'm going to do this. But you're essentially using anecdotal evidence, and you know, as I'm fond of saying, you know, the plural of anecdotes doesn't equal good data, right? And so, you know, when you take a step back and think about it, you know, organizations since the advent of the EHR are tracking dutifully every patient going through, yet we're unable to bring that real-world evidence back in to inform the decision. We're not really leveraging the institutional memory of organizations. So, you know, what we're really able to do now is begin to take what was once data exhaust, it was just stored and archived and never reused, and turn it into real-world evidence that can drive a decision. So what we're doing in oncology, we're working with ASCO and Institute Gustave Roussy. You spoke with Dr. Charles Ferte the other day around it. But is begin to bring this knowledge to bear. So, for instance, we can go in with an oncologist sitting next to a patient, trying to make a decision about the best agent for them, going beyond just their gut intuition in a clinical trial, again, which the patient might not have even qualified for several reasons. Dive into the medical record. The first step, of course, to your point earlier, is getting the molecular marker, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, in the real world, that exists typically in a pathology report or in a doctor's note, which are unstructured, right? So we have to dive in and do natural language processing, parse through the data and do linguistic analysis, because the report might say, you know, patient is, test BRCA positive today, however, has no family history, which is different from saying patient has history of BRCA positivity, however, test negative today. So we go in, we do NLP, linguistic analysis, map that into an ontology, and then take that tumor marker and then begin to dynamically create a microcord of matched patients, leveraging both internal patients who've been seen before as well as patients in registries, matching based on age, gender, ethnicity, comorbidities, like if they have renal failure, very tightly matched with the patient at hand, including their tumor marker, with a key exception, they've all been treated and you know the outcome of the treatment, right? So you can generate what's called a Kaplan-Meier curve from that. which shows time survival from time zero, where everyone's survived through 5 years, so your classic 5-year survival. And so you can compare the 5-year survival and the survival curves for varying therapies with a population very, very similar to the patient at hand. So it really is moving us toward precision medicine, where you're able to very precisely, based on real world evidence, and again, this is a well known fact, is that, you know, even a therapy that's successful in another organization, I mean, there's a lot of local factors to hospitals, whether it be expertise of the clinicians, the physical plant, the population they're treating, which causes variance in outcomes. So it's, you know, while you always want to go with a randomized controlled trial as you build standard, the real world outcomes within a given institution are incredibly important to understand it and to factor into the treatments.
So that's an incredible amount of detail, but this, your solution,
yeah,
which is called HANA, right?
Yeah.
Is ASCO's using it. So you've created and aggregated these comparative data sets to power precision medicine, right? So this is available now, and
yes,
you're networking many cancer centers together. So can you expand on that relationship with ASCO and a number of these cancer centers?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is all built on HANA. HANA is the in-memory computing platform that SAP built, and I'll give you a really quick genesis. And if I get too detailed, let me know, but I'm very passionate about this. But, you know, basically it was created because we serve 25 different sectors. Over 75% of the world's GDP flows through SAP. And so we really have, you know, we're the largest of the companies globally. And in information-intensive sectors, you know, a little over a decade ago, we noticed that, or we felt it, really running the software, that the old disks, where there was just far too much silos of information, both internal and external, and they were hitting a complexity wall. And this was happening about the same time as business was becoming more and more globalized and really shifting from, you know, something where it was a little more slower in pace to something pretty at real time successful, right? You know, so organizations can no longer afford to look at what happened last quarter, last year to get decision making. They really needed to be more organic, where like an organism, they're able to respond to what's happening right now and adjust, or even better, begin to predict what's likely to happen. And so this was built, you know, or released, I think, 2004, 2005. In 2010.
Right.
I thought you were wrong. In 2010, at least. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, this is a multi-billion dollar R&D budget over a number of years. And so this is what we've built the Connected Health platform on top of. And what that is takes what HANA is, an in-memory computing platform, and we layer on data ingestion tools that are specific for healthcare data sources, agile data model, which is easily extensible, medical ontology, and NLP engine, which is optimized for healthcare, amongst other things. So it really is a healthcareized instance of HANA called the Connected Health platform. And so,
and then a specialized version for oncology.
Yes, yes. And so ASCO is using
many, many
in the U.S. Yeah, yeah. And in Europe.
Worldwide,
yeah. Institut Gustave-Roussy, we talked to Charles yesterday. So they're a member of what's called Cancer Core Europe. And so that's a consortium there of oncology centers in Europe, and they're to move to the platform as well.
All powered by SAP.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. It's going to make a big difference in people's lives. So you're seeing some outcomes now. And,
well, we're,
and how do people find out? Where do they go on the web? More about the detail that we started talking about and some of the outcomes you've achieved, other than helping the soccer team win the World Cup.
Yeah, yeah. So you can go to the SAP website in the healthcare section, and we have a lot of information around it there. You know, we're early on still, and so we're excited to see this transition to, you know, broad use clinically. I think, you know, any provider who sits down and is able to store the data and really move to what I call a more conversational approach to have a user interface on massive data sets. And you can start out with an idea and drill down on it and explore the data. And based on what you're seeing, adjust your line of questioning. And unlike other technologies where predefined dimensions or data cubes that are constructed in certain ways, that help you, as long as you go within the dimensions that they've formed, you're good. What we're able to do with this technology is really make it conversational. So, you know, you as a domain expert, an administrator, can sit down with data and really explore it through and find an answer pretty rapidly.
Well, thanks for stopping by. At
my pleasure. Thanks, Doug.
And we'll be talking to you next year.
Absolutely.
And maybe some specific examples and outcomes with patients and improved therapy.
Yeah. Next year in Vegas, right?
Yeah, next year in Vegas. Thanks.
Hey, I left with him in November of 2009. That's almost 8 years.
And hello, this is Fred Goldstein at the Conversa booth here, HIM 17, day 3. It's been an exciting morning. I'm joined now by Michael Guy. And Michael is with Information Builders.
Correct.
We're excited to have you here. Some work with Information Builders, a series of webinars for them a couple months back that we did on discussing build versus buy and data. So, Michael, give us a little bit of background on yourself and the company to start.
Sure. Thank you. So I started off in the working world as an accountant, constantly making debits equal credits, and decided to get into information technology because you're just never going to learn everything that there is to learn. So I started off in application programming and ran an application development shop for a utility company, and then I moved over to the software side of the world and technical support, and then pre-sales support, and ultimately in sales. And so I've been in primarily software sales for a lot of years, healthcare the last 10 years. Recently came back to IBI for my second tour of duty.
Uh-huh.
I was here a number of years ago and for personal reasons had to make a move to a different city, but glad to be back after 18 years. So Information Builders is, I think we're celebrating our 40th year. This year, we're a privately held company out of New York. We made our entry into the technology world via analytics, and discovered over the years that we were really, really good at accessing data across a variety of systems. And as we looked at the changing healthcare market and when really the value-based care initiative started, it became clear to us that in order to really be effective in terms of lowering cost and improving care, you need to be able to access data across all the many different siloed systems within healthcare. So we built a product called OmniHealth Data. We have both a provider edition as well as a payer edition that really automates the data integration, data acquisition, data cleansing, mastering process to ultimately deliver a data repository that can span the continuum of care, leverages itself for self-service analytics as well as just analytics in general.
And when you talk about pulling data from different sources, can you talk about some of those components? I guess it's like hospital and then others.
The various EMR systems that are out there, excuse me, ambulatory systems, pharma systems, just all the various systems that you would see.
And can you also pull data from non-healthcare related systems and bring them into that warehouse as well, so as people begin to look at broader data sets?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about our partnership with St. Luke's, but one of the applications that we're bringing to the market with them is around patient satisfaction. So that's pulling data from Press Ganey as well as other outside sources.
And then that goes into a warehouse where they can select. And you also provide expertise about building those BI tools and using various tools, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So WebFocus is our analytic tool that's for the desktop. Has a number of wonderful features about it that allows folks to do some very in-depth analytics as well as self-service analytics.
It really is an interesting time because the data is becoming critical. Everyone knows it, whether you type population health or segmentation, stratification, where's my risk in my population, all those things. You really have to pull together much more data sets because the granularity you can get out of that then really allows you to target individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about the quadruple aim and we just, you know, pick on lowering the cost of care, you really need to understand where are all of the components that drive your cost for a procedure, right? So that's not only things within the hospital itself, What are labor costs that goes into that procedure? What are the supply costs that go into that procedure? Really going to be effective about driving down the cost of care. You've got to be able to access all of those systems that contribute to the cost of care, so you know where to analyze.
And I would assume you build a system like that that has that multiple different data feeds, different data sets, all kinds of different vendors. It has to be fairly flexible, I would guess, so you can link to all these different people, and so one hospital system, you may be building it one way or another, it might be a different. Is that pretty much?
Yeah, so the underlying data repository repository is very flexible and customizable to, you know, take care of the nuances from one hospital system to the next. But I think most hospital systems will get that, you know, 80 to 90% of the analytics that they do are consistent across.
The same stuff.
Exactly.
Right, right. Mentioning St. Luke's, right?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that. What's
so
doing there?
That is a first-of-a-kind partnership within Information Builders. St. Luke's has been a phenomenal customer to work with. They went through an RFP process a couple of years ago. They were really trying to build a data repository that would allow them to do analytics and the things that they needed to do to address the quadruple aim. So They purchased our OmniHealth Provider Edition. They purchased WebHealth. And in the course of 18 months, they built over 60 applications that pull data from over 30 data sources. And
wow.
So what we've done is we've looked at that inventory of applications that they've built. We've highlighted four that we're going to market most. And those are around hospital patient experience, a hospital system balanced scorecard, physician practice management, as well as the inpatient safety indicators. And that one really is broader than just patient safety indicators. So they'll look at outcomes, they'll look at oncology, they'll look at infections. So what we're doing is we're taking those assets, we're bringing them in-house, productize them, and then we'll sell them back out to the market.
And so in essence, another hospital has already pre-done.
Absolutely. So we believe with the automation that we can bring to the table in terms of data acquisition and the fact that all of these dashboards have been built already, within a 4 or 6 month time frame, we should be able to immediately expose all of those analytic data and begin to use those applications immediately.
And do you have a report or white paper written on that?
We do.
Where did he find that?
Booth 1831.
1831 and on the web?
Or you can go to the Information Builders website.
And is that informationbuilders.com?
Informationbuilders.com.
Great, yeah. So up there they can pick up that report. So what kind of new things are you doing, or where do you see the field going?
Wow. There's so much going on. I certainly feel that looking at predictive and prescriptive analytics around propensity for a disease state or effectiveness of care plans. I think those are areas that the industry is starting to look at. There's still a lot of basic blocking and tackling. People are still trying to get their arms around the data. But as we look out, I see that. I'm very interested in incorporating behavioral and socioeconomic data. For me personally, the world of mental health and behavioral health provides a great opportunity for us to leverage data to really change the cost equation. And what makes that challenging is not only do you have to have the behavioral data and the mental health data about the patient, but you also have to have the clinical data about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Information Builders is uniquely positioned to bring both of those disciplines of data together for a care team to make effective decisions about
right.
a patient.
No, I really think, you know, you've seen a fair amount of it around the conference over the last couple of days, and also, you know, just in the industry as a whole, recognizing that there's a whole lot going on out in the world for individuals, all the social determinants of health, and that data needs to be ingested, presented to a provider in a usable format, and then allowing them to then make the appropriate recommendations or behavior change types approaches to help that individual out.
Absolutely. I definitely agree.
And so you're looking out building those in over time?
Yes, absolutely. We have a number of other apps from St. Luke's that we're taking a look at to release in this next bundle of applications. So they just have a vast wealth of already built applications that we think the market would be ripe for.
Right. And so it sounds like, you know, the Information Builder system is you can take something that's been built by somebody else within the app, in the system, and use it as an app, or you could do your own.
Of course.
Which is different from some where it's here's what you get. You know, we've configured these 50 and that's it or whatever. This is a more of a customizable application.
Yeah, I think you know, the choices out in the market today are buy tools and build it yourself.
Right.
Or take something that's been built and conform your business to that. And what we're offering is the ability to take something that's been built, customize it if you need to. But we really believe that the time to value with this approach is going to be potentially one third of what you would do in a build your own, do it yourself.
Yeah, completely
scenario.
Build it, right.
Right.
Because you've, and Information Builders also has a broader non-healthcare business, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
And that, and I want you to touch because that expertise can be brought into healthcare where some of these industries are possibly further along in their development than us healthcare folks.
Absolutely. So, yes, we have a strong presence in financial services and insurance, a strong presence in state, local government. But I think if you look at the retail industry and the financial industry, you know, 20 years ago, they began to struggle with you and I as a consumer, right? And healthcare is just beginning to
right.
realize that I'm not a I'm a consumer. And so I think a lot that we can bring from the knowledge that Information Builders has and these other industries that have really engaged with the consumer and bring that expertise to healthcare as well.
And I think that's right on target because, you know, and I've seen this now the last 2 years, healthcare really is beginning to understand that these folks in the retail business have been doing this a lot longer. They know it. We can make me decide what I'm buying. Why can't I turn that lens on changing my behavior about my health or changing a provider's behavior? So you've been working that market, you said, for years now, 40 years at the company, and building those platforms, and obviously that expertise can flow across in the healthcare sector, which I think is great.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. I think we've really got to affect the behavior of the consumer to really move folks to that wellness side of the equation if we're really going to affect the cost of care.
Are there any things you've seen here at the conference that are exciting you, or how's the conference been for Information Builders itself?
Well, it's been so good for Information Builders that I had an opportunity to wander the floors.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
the booth's been hammered.
The booth has been hammered. My feet are tired.
That's great. Well, okay, that's fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any new exciting stuff coming out? You talked about the St. Luke's. Any others?
Yeah, well, that is definitely, you know, one of the things that we're doing. I mentioned earlier that we've got a provider edition of OmniHealth and a payer edition. Over the course of the next couple of months, we're going to actually be converging those two data models because, as you well know, there's a lot of convergence going on in the market between payers and providers.
So will this allow providers then to begin to have the resources and tools they need to manage risk?
Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic.
As well as providers as well.
As providers do the provider stuff and then begin to manage more like a health plan as we see that convergence you talked
about.
Yeah,
because I think the more and more we move into value-based care, the more and more risk sharing is going to become for the norm. So you've got to have the data to understand what your costs are so that you know what your tolerance for risk.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Michael.
Thank
it's
you.
To have
appreciate
you
it. Absolutely.
And, always great to have Information Builders in. Go to informationbuilders.com. You can find the stories, I guess, the St. Luke's information and other stuff on the product. So
wonderful.
Thanks again.
Thanks a bunch.
Enjoy the conference.
Take care.
All right.
Thank you.
And there you have it from Information Builders. We're now going to bring in Jess. You can do another little talk here. So this is Health Innovation Media at the HIM17 conference.
Hi, this is Jessica DeMassa, and I'm back here with Health Innovation Media. We are broadcasting live from the Conversa Health booth, and I am joined right now by Jamie Edwards. Jamie, why don't you introduce yourself for everybody who's listening?
Sure. Jamie Edwards, the CEO of Cloudbreak Health, which is a unified telemedicine platform that's in 650 hospitals doing over 60,000 encounters a month.
Wow, Jamie. So tell me a little bit more about Cloudbreak. So unpack that for me. What does that all mean?
Sure. The company actually started as a language services business. So hit a button on the screen and within 30 to 60 seconds, get your interpreter resource at the push of a button. We currently cover 60 languages, doing, you know, in video and 250 in audio. But what we realized was that over time we had 5,000 video endpoints in the field and that hospitals were having problems collaborating with each other. And we saw our platform as a mechanism to do that. So we started adding other services like telestroke, telepsych. And after that, it just seemed natural to keep adding specialties and specialties and specialties.
Oh, so you're building like a marketplace, more or less.
We're building a healthcare marketplace and making telemedicine frictionless.
So is it frictionful right now?
Yes. So currently, as it sits today, if we go back for history, right, telemedicine 1.0 was pick up the phone, call your doc. Telemedicine 2.0 was let's add video. But the video that was added, the investments that were made, they were largely around WebRTC technologies, which by default aren't interoperable. Right, you have to have the same software or the same browser on, you know, each side of that discussion. So, for us, what we attempted to do was create an open standards video platform and make video interoperable.
Okay.
So on our platform, whether you're on Skype for Business, Polycom, VidYO, or Cisco, we can integrate that and make a call as easy as just handing a dial number. And so what it's done is it's allowed hospitals who are on one platform to collaborate with hospitals who are on another and really democratize, if you will, the market, because now we're breaking down silos.
Okay, so no longer do I need to just talk to the one person who has the other piece of software that can talk to mine. I can talk to anybody.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And so that
anyone
allows
who's on
this whole
standards-based video.
Okay, and so that allows this whole marketplace concept to really be something that you can build toward, because it's like you can pull in resources from everywhere.
Right. And imagine a hospital who once was saying, I need to have telemedicine, and I'm going to do it as a consumer because I need to bring services into this hospital. Now say, well, I can offer it as well. So on our platform, someone can consume language services and consume telepsych from some of our leading partners. And on the other side, they can provide telestroke or provide tele-GI and telenephrology. It's turned this telemedicine discussion into something that's a strategic imperative for hospitals, and it's allowed them to get an ROI far above what they would get with another provider.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I feel like, generally speaking, in the industry, we've been hearing a lot more about telemedicine. I feel like actually it's having its moment right now. Everybody is looking for a telemedicine solution. We're looking at it as a way to reduce the cost of care. And I think even with rural hospitals, this is a way for them to stay in business more or less.
Sure.
So it's really becoming, you know, more of a critical issue in terms of accessibility of care. About what you're seeing, I mean, from your vantage point, you know, in terms of some of the trends moving forward, what's next then for telemedicine?
Yeah, well, for us, right, we started off as a healthcare disparities company, and the first disparity that we saw was limited English proficient and deaf and hard of hearing patients. And then we discovered, you had mentioned rural telemedicine.
Yeah.
There are just as many medical deserts in some of our nation's largest cities today as there are in rural healthcare. People just seem to understand the rural use case better.
Sure.
It's about... Yes, I can totally conceptualize that if I'm in a rural environment, I might not have access to a neurologist. Right? So great, we'll bring that in over telemedicine. But even in Los Angeles, and an example of that is the partnership that we have with Avanti Hospitals and University of Southern California. So Avanti was a language services client. And what ended up happening was they said, we want to become an accredited stroke center. And we want to do that via telemedicine. And we want to be able to keep patients in our community so we don't have to transfer them out to a higher level of care. Because the studies have shown that if you're transferring patients out to a higher level of care, it's a much longer recovery time. They don't have their local support network,
sure.
Right? Mom can't come in and stop in at the hospital so easily because I'm 10 miles down the road as opposed to 2 miles down the road. And so in order to improve outcomes, they said we want to keep people in the community and within their support systems. So we were able to structure a deal between them and the University of Southern California so they could have tier one academic stroke consults, right? We're going to be seeing much more of that type of use of telemedicine going forward. We view it as the new stethoscope.
Okay.
Every doctor should be integrating telemedicine into their daily practice. It is a much more efficient way to be able to handle certain parts of their care days. Right,
that's
whether it's synchronous
or
asynchronous.
No, and it is a tool, and I think, it's opening things up for more collaborative kind of medicine, more collaborative care, which is going to lead to hopefully better care for the patient.
Well, that's exactly right. So one thing that we're looking at doing is structuring a care team around the patient.
Okay.
And the hashtag for our company is humanized healthcare. And everyone's talking about being patient-centric. So we're on board with that train. But the way that we think we solve that problem is by making the technology obscenely easy to use for the provider. And most of the tools that we've given providers today...
Not easy.
Not easy to use. I think electronic medical records are kind of case in point
when
it comes to that, right? So what we're trying to do is say, let's restore a little bit of the joy of calling back to these physicians. Let's make their lives easier. And let's make the tech fun for them to use. Why are we so afraid of fun in healthcare?
I love that, and I love the humanized healthcare tagline. And I think, you know, being a telehealth company, it's interesting because it's like you literally are, you know, humanizing by putting a face to that care on the other side of the phone or
right.
whatever device it comes across.
Right. And so now we can take this technology and use it to break down the four walls of a hospital and extend what we're calling branded care networks into the community. On our platform, they're all private label. So if one of our clients says, hey, Jamie, we'd like to have a telemedicine initiative and get started, I'd like to consume these services from you, provide the network, we create that platform in their look and feel, launch it into the marketplace, but it's interoperable with the rest of the hospitals that are on the platform.
Yeah, and we know interoperability is one of the best buzzwords here at
HIMSS.
Yes, year after year.
I'm amazed at the number of interface companies that are here right
now. Oh, there are a lot of interface companies.
People clearly see a need and need to address it.
Yes, clearly. Speaking of HIMSS, what else are you seeing here at HIMSS?
I'm amazed at the breadth of the show.
Really? In what way?
Besides the fact that the exhibit hall is like a mile long.
Yeah.
Right? And we've definitely all gotten our steps in going to see all the companies. Seeing the proliferation of more interface companies that are out there, because typically I've always thought there are three or four go-tos, but now you're seeing new modalities applied to interfacing, even artificial intelligence, and seeing some of that happen
here.
Yeah,
definitely.
Seeing more medical groups show up saying we'd like to offer our services, via telemedicine using the technology. There's been a lot of process, a lot of workflow solutions.
Yes, I've seen a lot of workflow solutions, a lot of risk solutions here as well.
Yes.
Is there anything that's been missing for you? You've been coming to HIMSS for a while.
Yeah.
Anything that you're surprised that you haven't seen?
You know, not yet.
Okay.
I think the really exciting thing about healthcare is each year you come to HIMSS, there's a new little crop or subsegment of companies that pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, I didn't know people were looking to address that need, and that's great. It's great to see that, there's riches in the niches, if you will, and people are really starting to get involved with the specialization of the tools that can be applied. But I think it's really great to be able to get 40,000 people together who are focused on solving healthcare's biggest issues in one place. And it's one of my favorite things about the conference is being able to come back, meet people who are doing really cool things in healthcare and see that progress.
So talk to me a little bit about some of the people that you've been, talking with over the last couple of days. Because I always feel like some of the best conversations happen, in between the sessions,
in
the meetings, like in the networking events that happen afterwards. So what's everybody talking about? What have you been in conversations about? I'm interested to know from your vantage point.
Interoperability is a big deal.
Okay.
We are definitely hearing from the market that the concept of what we're doing in telemedicine. So one of the things that we're in the process of developing right now is an EMR normalization engine.
What is that?
Right. So all telemedicine physicians who are working at multiple hospitals currently have to learn multiple EMRs.
Right.
So our goal as a company is to say, why is that? We should be able to show them one interface and have everything happen on the back end from an integration standpoint.
Okay.
Right. So if I'm a physician and I'm a neurologist and I have hospital A, hospital B, hospital C, I learn one platform. I log into that platform, happens on the back end. I can document in those systems through this single interface, and it makes my life 10 times easier because I don't have to learn McKesson, Epic, and Cerner if that happens to be who the hospitals are. And each one of those companies has great platforms.
Sure.
But what they haven't done well is play nicely with each other.
Right.
Right. And there was actually an interesting article that I actually just tweeted that was around Epic coming up with a more open platform. Right. And so for that instance, seeing Epic move in that direction, who typically one would thought of as being, somewhat siloed, has an amazing EMR product, but to see them move towards open is really great.
That's excellent. That's some good leadership from a very big company. And Jamie, real quick before we move off of that point, if anybody wants to find that article on Twitter, what's your handle so they can look you up?
At Jamie Edwards, J-A-M-E-Y Edwards.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, thank you.
The other thing I wanted to ask you real quick, one of the things that's been surprising me actually at this conference is how people are not really talking about the things that are happening in the political environment around us.
Right.
It's been like we've been blissfully unaware here on the trade show floor in Orlando, and it's been surprising to me how people are really not talking about the potential of ACA repeal. Have you been hearing anything about that? And what's the vibe you're getting?
Yeah, the buzzword of the day is uncertainty.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about that.
if there's one thing that we've seen, it's that the current regime is unpredictable, or maybe predictably unpredictable is a way to say it. And so everyone's waiting with bated breath saying, okay, which way is the direction going? Is ACA going to be repealed? What we're hearing President Trump say, I was used to saying Mr. Trump and then President-elect Trump and now President Trump, is centered around that he's actually starting to move towards some of the ideas that are there. Maybe all of the ACA isn't so bad. So I think certain ideas are going to stick.
Okay,
one of
those
ideas, value-based purchasing, I think is a great example of that. Some of the innovations that have come of CMS have been great ideas and great leaps forward and great steps of progress. I think value-based purchasing and moving away from the fee-for-service environment is a big part of that. When you take a look at value-based purchasing, that makes HIMSS all the more important because it's these technologies that are going to create value for patients and value for providers going forward.
Right.
They're analytics that are going to empower patients to take more control of their care. And that was actually a big theme that we've been hearing is how do we empower the patient?
Yeah.
One of my big, you know, things I believe in wholeheartedly is that we as a nation and we as a healthcare system have almost done too good of a job of taking care of people and not demanding enough responsibility from the patient. Right? We never want to take the human component out of it. And part of that is taking responsibility for ourselves and our own lives. And so how do you do that?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Well, you know, I think you spoke to ePatient Dave
earlier,
right?
I did a few moments ago.
And one of his things is let's give them the information they need to be successful.
Right.
How many people in this room could raise their hand and say they have access to their own patient record? How many people are actually making use of the information that's on their Fitbit and integrating it and using it to change their human behaviors? Those are the types of things that I think are going to be really powerful going forward. So value-based purchasing and then patient empowerment.
Patient empowerment. Well, Jamie, I think we are close to our mark here, right? We've got about time for one more question or
okay,
so.
Sure.
So I'm curious to know, you know, you've been walking around. What kinds of things are you looking for from your perspective? I mean, you're the CEO of a telehealth company. So
yeah.
what kinds of things are you looking for and have your eye out for in terms of innovation on the health IT side?
I'm a little bit of an exponential technology freak. I love researching and hearing about things like blockchain, artificial intelligence, 3D printing. Those types of technologies that are really game changers.
Yeah.
There are some technologies that are evolutionary. And as much as I am in the telemedicine business, I understand that telemedicine is an evolutionary technology.
Sure.
And it can change the game in a big way, but it is a simple, practical solution to what is a big problem. But when you take a look at something like artificial intelligence and its applications, and IBM Watson is here and a few other companies, right? You take a look at those technologies, and those are really, really exciting. And their potential is boundless.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people fear that boundless potential, and a lot of people are starting to embrace the boundless potential. But even those leapfrogging technologies, those game-changing technologies have an evolutionary aspect. So artificial intelligence first application is going to be to help providers make better decisions by being able to analyze data on their behalf. But the provider should still be driving the show,
right,
and is still driving the show. So it's a melding of this human and technology aspect that I think we're going to be seeing more of going forward.
Is there, in terms of, we were talking with ePatient Dave earlier about blockchain, and we got into this ancillary discussion about paradigm shift, and, you know, what that really means in terms of, like, you know, changing the mindset and the expectations and the demands of what the generation around that paradigm shift wants.
Right.
And so I'm wondering from your vantage point, you know, what kinds of things are you seeing in the marketplace as far as shifting wants and needs from providers? I mean, what has all of this technology done? Has it made them better consumers? I mean, we hear a lot about the consumerization of healthcare, and, you know, there's obviously we're sitting in the middle of this giant church, so there's a lot of choice that can be made. So what are you seeing in your clients and the hospital systems and the providers you work with? What kind of demands are they putting on telemedicine?
They want it to be simple.
Okay.
And they really want to understand the business models around it.
Well, talk more about that.
Telemedicine has typically been looked at as, if we're going to go through our strategic process, oh, we need to be doing it because other hospitals are doing it. And yes, it does seem like a better way to care for patients, but where's the ROI? And so the ROI initially started off as cost avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do to make sure this patient doesn't readmit to the hospital? Where I can do a telemedicine visit, and after discharge, I can do a post-discharge follow-up call with them via telemed. I can look at the wound, see if it's infected,
right,
and work towards early intervention in case something happens so that they don't have to come back to the facility.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can, if they were dispositioned to the skilled nursing facility, I can do that as well. Part of good follow-up is driving that process. So people have asked us for those types of services.
Sure.
We have seen our hospitals want an integrated platform. So why are they have, I won't mention names. Why do they have vendor A for patient portal, vendor B for telepsych, vendor C for telestroke, and they're all on different technology platforms?
Is it possible for those to converge?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're sitting here with thousands of booths around us. Is that
possible?
We've
done it. We've done it. It's been done today, and we have it rolled out. We have it rolled out. Actually, the USC Avanti partnership is a great example of that.
Okay.
Right? Because they're getting language services and they're getting telestroke all on a single platform. And we are currently working with one of the largest telepsych companies in the country to do the same thing for them.
Excellent. Well, we know convergence is what the future ahead, especially as far as exponential technologies and things go. And we look forward to seeing, Jamie, what you at Cloudbreak are going to be able to do to help, you know, drive more innovation and more convergence in terms of what what people are looking for in these solutions in telemedicine.
It seems to be the natural evolution of things, right?
Definitely. So thank you for joining us. We are going to be talking now, I think, to Mandy Bishop in a second here from Aloha Health.
Amazing. Yes. I haven't met Mandy in person yet. I'm going to get to do this today.
For
I'm so excited.
For those of you who are listening, Jamie, there's our large Twitter community, all of our tweets who are joining us. And so we are all friends of the hashtag Pink Socks movement
yes.
as well.
Yes.
So if you want to follow Jamie on Twitter, you're at Jamie, J-A-M-E-Y, Edwards. And then we'll be talking to Mandy in a moment here. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
Jamie,
for having me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to hear about telehealth and the work that you're doing to humanize healthcare.
Well, until HIMSS 18.
Until. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like we've got,
No pressure. Jamie said I have to. So Jamie said I have to say brilliant things. Oh, well, that shouldn't be hard.
No pressure.
So, Mandy and Jessica DeMassa, it's good to meet
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's good to meet you.
I think we've only met in Twitter land.
On Twitter.
So,
the Twitter sphere, man. The power of the Twitter sphere to connect is just unparalleled.
It really is.
Yeah.
It is. And so for everybody who may not know you on Twitter, what is your handle so they can look you up real quick?
Okay, I am at Mandy B Pro, and it is MandiBPro.
Okay, perfect. So everybody can look up Mandy.
That's right. Be careful
Follow
not to spell
her.
The wrong way. There's a whole other thing.
Yeah, it's brilliant and insightful. So I'm going to actually jump up. I would like to talk about, actually, why don't you introduce yourself for everybody who's listening here.
Sure.
Tell us about what you're doing with Aloha Health and just who you are in general.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm Mandy Bishop. I'm the CEO, chief evangelist, and co-founder of Aloha Health. So we are a relatively new startup. We've been around for about 6 months now, and we are focused 100% on making social and behavioral determinants of health actionable for program design decision support, clinical intervention decision support, and engagement decision support to help really personalize the healthcare experience and design the appropriate care pathway and the appropriate engagement methodology for you as a person.
Okay, break that down for me, Mandy, because
that was
a
whole lot.
So
say that you go to see your doctor and that you're a diabetic patient, right?
Okay.
And say that you're going to have particular challenges around your lifestyle. You're going to have a particular way that your family interacts. You're going to have a particular where you live and how you live and the opportunities that exist within your community are going to impact your ability to manage your health. So if your doctor is able to understand the challenges and the motivations and the unique trust factors that are yours and yours alone, they would be better able to facilitate a care management plan that's going to work for you. So that is what we are developing, is the opportunity to make that level of insight. It's not enough to say we know that these things matter, like the social universe matters and, you know, where you live matters. We all know geography is a vital sign, like, but it's not enough to know that it matters. It's having to be able to access what I should do about it at the point of care that is going to be transformational. So that's what we're working on.
Okay, so how are you doing this? Because that is a massive undertaking.
It is a massive undertaking. It is a giant.
We've got this whole thing solved. It's done. That's right. It's all figured out.
Yeah, so right now we are, it's a progression, right? So we're eating the elephant one bite at a time. And so the bite that we are taking off right now is we've identified our baseline data sources. And so we've identified this kind of universe of social and behavioral data points that are outside of the healthcare sphere. So we're not talking about claims data. We're not talking about clinical data.
What are we talking about?
I am talking about things like, you know, socioeconomic data around you, right?
Okay.
Demographic data, socioeconomic data. I'm talking about survey-based data that understands the trust factors, like what information sources do you trust for what means? So if I'm talking about healthcare, do you trust websites? Do you trust user-generated content that's on YouTube? Do you trust newsletters? You know, do you trust print media? Do you trust information that comes from a provider? Do you trust your pharmacist? Information comes from a pharmacist. What kind of information? Is it a billboard? Is it a brochure? Like, is that level of specificity about the information sources? And then things about, you know, your household. Are you a multi-generational household? So if you are a Medicare, you know, if you're a Medicare recipient, are you caring for young grandchildren and do you have, you know, adult children living with you? If you are an adult parent, like, are you a sandwich generation where you're caring for your children, you're also caring for your elderly parents who are living in the same household? And how does that impact your ability to access care appropriately? Mm-hmm. And how does that impact your ability to effectively care for yourself? So all of those data points that exist outside of healthcare, those are the things we're looking at. So we've started by identifying the data points that we believe matter.
Okay.
Yeah, that we and amassing a data set and blending in your data sources from things like climatology data, crime data, traffic data.
You're kidding.
No.
Okay.
That's all incredible. Of these things that matter,
no,
right?
It does.
These things all matter.
Doubt.
Yeah,
right.
Because if I can't, I'm not going to tell you from an exercise program standpoint that you need to get out and walk around your neighborhood if there are 57 active gangs within
right.
your neighborhood. Like, I'm just, that's probably not going
to
be
advice that's not going to be helpful to
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Push text messages, right?
Like, you know, being dead is probably not healthy,
no,
right? Like, we want to make
not.
Sure that we prevent.
There's a greater
harm.
Health risk in you going out to work out than there is for you to just stay in.
Exactly. So you would recommend maybe alternative exercise
sure.
programs. Like, those, but that's the kind of insight